When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about a gorgeous book, a fascinating book, an intricate book, a book that's got really a lot of things in it. Written by Dr. Amanda Wonder, who's here with us today. The book is titled Spanish Fashion in the Age of Velázquez, published by Yale University Press earlier in 2024, both in English and in Spanish, which is quite cool. But I don't speak Spanish or read it. So our conversation today will be fully focused on the English language version. However, I did want to mention that it exists in another language already as well. And this book takes us to the time, the place, what it was really like in a lot of ways at the court of Philip IV, as told through the life and work of the royal tailor. I found this to give us a really interesting perspective on all sorts of things, on religion, on gender, on opulence, on politics, on war. Really, there's a lot to get into. So Amanda, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's great to be here.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I'm a cultural historian based in New York City with a focus on early modern Spanish art and culture. And like so many people, I found myself absolutely baffled by the fashions that I was seeing in court portraits from Spain from the 16th and 17th centuries. And so, in fact, I remember being in the Prado once and seeing a little boy talking to his mom, standing in front of a portrait of the Infanta Margarita wearing this enormous silver and pink dress. And the boy said to his mom, Mama, ¿por qué está tan gorda? Like, why is she so fat? Referring to the hips that were extended so wide. And the mother, you know, gave an answer that was as good as I could give at that point. She said, you know, that's just kind of the fashion of the time. And so I wanted to do more of a deep dive into figuring out what was going on. You know, why did the clothes look like this? They look so strange to us today. And what I ended up doing was going to the Royal Palace archives, and I found that I just kept going back to the documents by the people who actually made the clothes. That was just the most interesting thing to me, was this whole world of court artisans who were the ones who actually produced the garments that we're seeing in the paintings. And so that's over a long period of time is what turned into this book.
I always think that books that start from moments of curiosity tend to end up with something interesting. So I'm not surprised that that's where this started. If we're going to talk, obviously, quite a lot about a royal tailor, we should probably understand kind of what that job actually was in this time period. So what did it mean to be a tailor in the 17th century? What were the kind of cultural connotations and assumptions made about someone who was a tailor? And how do we even know?
Great question. So, you know, it's what I found that was really interesting was that what it meant to be a tailor was varied quite a bit. There's been some really terrific work of social history on tailors in Madrid, for instance, already. And there's been a lot of studies about conflict in the world of the tailors. In the 17th century in particular was a time of really increasing inequality in Madrid amongst the tailors. And so you had a few select tailors, the tailors who were employed by the court, who were at the very top. And then you had a much larger number of tailors who were barely able to make a living. And so there's a wide range in terms of what it means to be a tailor in terms of what you're doing and what your lifestyle is and how well you're compensated for your work. So again, at the very top is if the one person who has that coveted position of being tailor to the queen or tailor to the king. In terms of the reputation of the tailors, it's funny, there was a real pop culture sensibility of the tailors as being as a professional group as being very suspicious and people who couldn't be trusted. And you'll find this in a lot of theatrical works and short stories, works by Cervantes and Quevedo and other writers from the time period. And this really stems from the fact that, well, two things. The first one being that tailors were working with materials that were so absolutely precious and expensive, which was textiles. And textiles were, it's so hard for us, I think, to even comprehend how valuable textiles were at this time. And so when you hired a tailor to make a garment, you provided the tailor with the fabric to make the garment. And so there was a lot of built-in suspicion that the tailor might be stealing remnants of fabric and somehow tricking you or telling you that you needed to buy more fabric than you actually needed and keeping the rest. And I would point out that this is not unique to Spain. This was also, you'll find this was the case in England as well as Spain. So this is kind of a universal concern about tailors in early modern Europe. Also, there was some suspicion of tailors in terms of how close they got to their clients, particularly their female clients. Lope de Vega wrote a poem of a jealous lover, you know, envying the tailor of the woman who was the object of his devotions. And so, again, in the pop culture, there was a lot of mocking of tailors, and it wasn't helped by the fact that the word for tailor in Spanish is sastre, which rhymes with desastre. And so the idea that the tailor was a disaster in some way is something that pops up quite a bit in poetry at the time.
I found this deeply entertaining because I definitely was not expecting to read that in this book of like, hang on, tailors are seen as like suspicious. All right.
Exactly.
Right. That's interesting cast on all of this.
It is. It's surprising. And it's funny. I have a graduate student right now who's doing a terrific research project about locks and locksmiths in early modern Spain. And she's actually found very similar things about locksmiths. The locksmiths were the subject of great suspicion because, you know, of course, they had the keys to your house. So it's not just the tailors.
Fair enough. While we're still talking about tailors kind of in the big picture, before we get into our specific tailor, is there anything further you'd like to say about sort of sources used for these sorts of things?
Sure. So, you know, the sources are, the sources are really rich, but also, how do I put it? It's varied. And so the reason I ended up really focusing on a royal tailor was primarily because this is what's so well documented. And the Palace Archive in Madrid has a collection of documents that are the Cuentas de Artesanos, so the artisans' accounts. And you'll find in these documents that there was a great deal of surviving documentation on tailors, which made it possible for me to do this project. On the other hand, for instance, if you wanted to write about the wig makers, which would be an incredibly fascinating subject because of the wigs that we see in the portraits, there's hardly anything at all. So it was really the luck of the fact that there was so much material available on tailors. And within the Cuentas de Sastres, what I found was this one name kept popping up over and over again in the documents. And it was the name of Mateo Aguado, who was the tailor to the queen for over 40 years. And the fact that there was so much surviving documentation of his work was again, what made it possible for me to do this project.
Mm. Always good to know about a good archive. So thank you for that. Before we get into Aguado in more detail, I want to kind of continue this painting of the picture of the world in which he operates, right? So we have an idea now about the kind of world of a tailor. There's, you know, one at the top and a lot of others, how people are perceiving tailors. But what about the monarchy side of things? If we're talking about Philip, what is he doing to change Spanish fashion and therefore obviously the work that Spanish royal tailors are going to be doing? What is the influence of him on this career?
Great. Well, this is a really interesting moment in fashion history where when Philip IV comes to the throne in 1621, he's inherited a Spain that's has a lot of problems. There's a lot of social problems and a lot of economic problems. And so one of the, and he's a teenager. He's a young king. And so one of the first things he does is convene a council to determine what kinds of reforms need to take place. And what may seem strange from our perspective is that this council fixated to a large degree on fashion and about reforms of dress that needed to be implemented. And in fact, in the public, in terms of the implementation of all these reforms, it was the reform of fashion that caused the most sort of outcry and uproar. And it was quite dramatic, particularly in men's dress. And so really to draw a distinction between his reign and his father's reign, which was Philip III's reign, was very much associated with men in these enormous rough collars and very opulent opulent clothes. Philip IV had implemented a reform of men's dress, which was legally binding, which was for men to not wear these enormous rough collars and instead have this very plain, starched, simple collar called a valona, which is worn over a golia, which is this stiff neck band that served as sort of a platter for the collar high up around the neck. And so I think, you know, what these dress reforms illustrate is just how politically important fashion was during this time period. So you see under Philip IV's reign, a radical change in men's dress from 1623 onwards, when these chapters of reform are published. And then you don't really see women's dress changing too much until the 1630s. And it's evolving a bit more organically, a bit not so much according to the implementation of laws like the men's dress reform had been.
Okay, I did say we're not going to stay on this for too long, but I have to ask, why? Why did he care so much about not just fashion, but men's fashion particularly? Why was this so high on his priority list? And why did people react so much?
Right. I mean, I think this is such an interesting issue. I think that, you know, dress is really the most visible representation of power, and dresses this visual representation of sort of like what your reign is going to be like. And so, you know, we can picture these portraits of Philip IV dressed all in black with this, you know, simple starched collar, and it projects this austerity and it projects turning back away from the opulence of the previous reign. And so it's such a great way to show change. We're always fixated on what people are wearing, and whenever there's a state dinner the next day in the New York Times, there's an article by Vanessa Friedman about what was the first lady wearing and what did it mean. And that was the case then too.
All right, then, fair enough. The clothes might look very different, but some of the politics perhaps are familiar.
Right.
So we have the context kind of on both sides of the profession of being a tailor and the royal court. Introduce us to Aguado. Where was he from? How did he become the queen's tailor? And how do we know?
Right. So Mateo Aguado, I would argue, is the most important cultural figure in Spanish history that we've never heard of. He is the tailor to the queen's household from 1630 until 1672. And he comes to this position by a path that's not entirely clear, because his early years aren't very well documented. We don't really know too much about him until he's actually appointed tailor to the queen. Prior to that, we do know he was born in the village of Fuenlabrada, which is a village outside of Madrid, not too far from Madrid. And what we know about Fuenlabrada is that it was a village where, according to a survey that was taken in the later 16th century, everyone was poor. And so this would include even the few hidalgos or low-level nobles who lived there. It seems to me from the tax records that I was able to look at from this time period that it's possible that Aguado came to his profession through his mother's side. His mother, Catalina Munoz, shared a surname with the local tailor and some weavers in the village. And so I think perhaps that's where Aguado would have come to this. We do know that he moved to Madrid as a child. I think he was around 6 years old or so when he moved to Madrid, settled in the garment district, which was the parish of San Ginés, which is right in the center of Madrid near the Plaza Mayor, and grew up there. Presumably, he became a Taylor's apprentice, although we don't have that documented yet. I do hope someone will find that record somewhere sometime. But it's known for sure that he entered in the workshop of a master tailor named Francisco de Soria. And Francisco de Soria was the tailor to the queen and also the wealthiest tailor in all Madrid in the 1620s. And so when Soria died in 1630, Mateo Aguado was then given the appointment to take his place of being the sastre de cámara de la reina, the tailor to the queen's chamber.
Okay, so this is an interesting rise. You know, he's not, for example, inheriting the post from the previous queen's tailor, but he's there now. What is he actually doing? What is it like to, what is the process of making a garment for the Spanish queen? Does she walk in to your, well, I suppose he didn't have an office, but walk up to him and go, I want a dress, go? I mean, what was that process like?
Right. Well, so this was interesting, trying to sort of figure this out from the documents. And I should explain briefly that the documents that we have are the tailor's accounts. And so they're his records of what he made. And he would, at the end of sort of every quarter of the year, submit his accounts to be paid for his work. And so these are records listing, you know, every dress, every skirt, every garment that he produced, and describing the garment with the fabrics, the colors, the trimmings, and he would put down how much he thought his labor was worth for this garment, and then the crown would have a process that they would determine what they would actually pay him for, which was not what he was requesting. So that's what the documentation is. So in terms of figuring out, okay, what was this process? There are some ways to sort of read in between the lines of these documents and get a sense of what that process was like. And also you can then combine that with, there are these rules of etiquette that governed the court, which describe the different functionaries at the court and what their roles were supposed to be. So in short, we have a bureaucratic system where there is, you know, the entire queen's household is very structured. There's and there is a master of the queen's wardrobe who was a very, very high ranking nobleman. And he is the one who's technically in charge of the wardrobe. What I don't have in any way is any documentation showing orders being placed for garments to the tailor. There's nothing to show what was that process you're asking about in terms of actually ordering the garments. We don't see that. What we just see is what he actually made. But what we can learn from the accounts of the tailor is that the queen was in fact very actively involved in her wardrobe. We see this particularly with Isabel de Bourbon, who was the queen when he was first appointed up until her death in 1644. And so, for instance, he often mentions, well, he made a garment, but then the queen sent it back because she didn't like the buttons and he had to replace the buttons. Or he made something and the queen sent it back because she wanted a more brilliant lining in the garment. Or he'd started making something and then she decided she wanted something else. And so we see a lot of that back and forth between the tailor and the queen in terms of her making sure that her wishes are fulfilled in terms of what the final garment looks like.
What were the kinds of pieces that went, I mean, buttons, obviously, fabric. I mean, is it, you make the whole thing all at once? Can you, even pick a dress and be like, well, there's this layer, then this layer, then that layer. Like, this is really complicated stuff.
It is. And there's a whole sort of ecosystem in the court to generate these clothes. And so in addition to basically the tailor, really, I would say, functioned as like the project manager for a garment. And so the tailor to the queen, he would design the garments. And one really interesting detail is that Aguado's accounts show that there were certain points where he was paid to make drawings of decorations for dresses. Now, none of these have been found. They probably don't survive. But this is a really interesting fact because it shows that the tailor was, in fact, being compensated for this sort of creative, inventive work. So Aguado, it seems, would have designed the dresses. And then he's working with the royal silk merchants, which is their own, there are usually two of them, and they would provide the actual materials for the garment. And the silk records accounts are this amazing source, which detail not just the fashion fabric, the fabric that you would see on the outside of a dress, but also all the underlayers that went into a dress. So the royal silk merchants would provide, say, for example, a black velvet for a dress, but then they'd also provide many, many yards of things like canvas and buckram and kind of stiff interfacing fabrics that would be used in the construction of the garment. So that's a really interesting detail, I think. But then there's also the queen's embroiderer who would embroider the fabric. It seems usually, before it was actually made into a garment. And then in Aguado's workshop, which was probably based at his home, not at the palace. Their space was at a premium at the palace. And so a lot of these artisans worked at home. It seems he had, there could be up to 50 seamstresses working on a dress at the same time. There could be a dozen journeyman tailors working on a garment. So the tailor to the queen was really supervising a lot of labor by a lot of other people.
That's really interesting to think about. Mm-hmm. And of course, terms like project manager seem much more modern than we might expect. Given the number of different pieces that are needed to create a garment like this, I was pretty surprised, honestly, to read in the book that he wasn't just making clothes for the queen. There was a lot of other stuff that he was meant to be doing. What else was he doing, and how did he make it all work?
Right. It's kind of unbelievable how much he was doing. So in addition to being the queen's tailor, Aguado, and this is, not just Aguado, but anybody who filled this role, also had responsibilities to dress the royal children. So up until they became a certain age, male and female, the queen's tailor also had a lot of responsibilities to make gifts and favors that were given from the queen to her household. And this included a lot of different things. One of the big perks of employment at the court was to receive a gift of an annual suit of clothes. And in fact, some court employees would receive a gift of clothing instead of wages. And at the time, the gift of clothing could sometimes actually be worth more than someone's wages. So Aguado was responsible for making those annual gifts of clothing. Also, if there were any special dignitaries coming to town, Aguado would be responsible for making special gifts, diplomatic gifts of clothing. He also frequently was commissioned by the queen to make clothing to dress religious images, sculptures of the Virgin Mary and the Christ Child. And he even made clothes for the prince's toy soldiers and the Infanta's dolls. So Aguado had a huge portfolio of responsibilities. And in terms of, you asked the question of how did he do this, it seems that he absolutely never had a vacation. He was worked around the clock. On the eve of major holidays, he'd be up all night preparing things for the queen to wear the next day. He was someone who the job was an intense job.
Yeah, no, it really sounds like that. Going all the way from the scale of like the most ornate thing the queen might wear to a child's toy soldier uniforms. Like,
exactly.
That's a pretty extreme change. I want to ask about, though, some of the kind of more ornate side of things. I admit, slightly less interested in toy soldiers, but maybe that's just my bias. You're telling us all these things about sources and about kind of what the dresses were, and we've mentioned portraits a few times, but I think it's probably worth bringing them in more directly. Mm-hmm. How do we know what dresses he made? What visual evidence do we have, and to what extent do we actually still have the dresses themselves?
Right. Well, so in terms of dresses themselves, absolutely nothing. There is nothing that is known to survive that was made by Aguado or any royal dress from this period at all. So that's not a resource we have, which makes the portraits all the more important as the primary visual sources that we have to know what these things actually looked like. And one of the difficulties of this project was the fact that what we can read in the documents doesn't line up perfectly with what we can see in the portraits. And so very rarely is it possible to say, oh, this, you know, this dress that's documented is actually this dress that we see in a portrait. There are a few really close matches, which I describe in the book. For instance, there's a portrait of the Infanta Maria Teresa at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she's a child, about 6 years old, wearing a black dress with a very distinctive pattern of silver squares on the black fabric. And I found a document that shows that the Countess of Olivares, who was the wife of the, by this point, disgraced Count Duke of Olivares, had given the Infanta a gift of fabric that was black velvet embroidered with silver squares. And that was such a distinctive fabric. I didn't see any other fabrics that were black velvet embroidered with silver squares anywhere else in the documents. And so it seems likely that that was in fact the portrait is in fact showing this gift of this special fabric, but that's a rarity. We don't usually see such a close match. And then often, you know, I would sometimes find a fabric that appeared to be a good match for a dress and a portrait, but then the garments don't quite match exactly from one to the other. So there's never a perfect match. But in terms of the question of how do we know that Aguado made something that we see in a portrait, basically from what I could tell, it seems that everything passed through Aguado's hands. And so there was one person who was appointed to be the tailor to the queen. And so even if he didn't actually make everything, things went through him. So for instance, there was a gift of dresses by the Viceroy of Naples that were sent to all the members of the royal family in the 1650s. And this was such a fabulous gift that it was written up by chroniclers at the time. And it's a little tricky to understand exactly what was going on here, but it does seem that this was a gift of dresses that had been made in Naples, not just fabric that was sent from Naples. But the dresses do appear in Aguado's documents. So that indicates that, okay, he played some role in either refitting or reconstructing in some way the dresses that were sent over. So I think that pretty much any portrait that we're seeing of a royal woman from the Spanish court in the time that Aguado was the tailor to the queen, it seems that if Aguado didn't personally design the dress, he at least had a hand in its construction at some point.
Mm. Okay, that's helpful to clarify. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can maybe stay on the portraits, though, for a further mm-hmm. moment, because obviously, as you just mentioned, kind of sending textiles, sending garments around was a mm-hmm. really big deal. These portraits were also a pretty big deal. I mean, mm-hmm. what were the portraits made for? Who were they sent for? Like, what was the point of the portraits?
Oh, great question. Well, I mean, the portraits filled lots of different functions. And they play a really interesting role in Spanish society at this time. The portraits could really quite literally stand in for the royal person. So for instance, a portrait of, I was just talking about the Viceroyalty of Naples a little bit, a portrait of the king in Naples would really be a stand-in for the king where he couldn't be. We see something I think is absolutely fascinating is we often see in Madrid, for instance, if there are processional events, there's a procession going across town with a royal entry or something like that, you'll have portraits, royal portraits, life-size portraits hanging on the exteriors of buildings. And so you might have portraits by Velázquez actually hanging outside, again, representing, sort of standing in for the royal persons. And so if you didn't catch a glimpse of the queen during the procession, well, you would be able to see her in that portrait. We also have, of course, portraits sent as diplomatic gifts. There are a lot of portraits by Velázquez or by his workshop are sent to other courts, oftentimes as in the process of working out marriage negotiations. So there's lots of portraits of the Infantas, Maria Teresa and Margarita being sent to various courts in Vienna, Brussels and Paris, trying to line up suitors for these daughters of the king. So portraits fill lots of different functions, and they really are a way that information about dress gets out within Spain, but also to the wider world beyond Spain.
Hmm. No, that's very interesting. So thank you for adding that in. I want to pick up on something that we've kind of both mentioned, But it really is, I think, quite interesting because Aguado is the tailor to the queen, like in some ways the office of the queen. He keeps the job even when the queen changes, right?
Yes, exactly.
But presumably lots of other things, or at least about the work change. I mean, he's literally dressing a different woman. How did his work and career change as the queen did?
Right. This was a really interesting thing to trace, was how a royal artisan's fortunes were absolutely dependent on what was happening with the monarchy. And so, for instance, when Queen Isabel de Bourbon dies in 1644, this really put Aguado in a tough spot because he kept his job, as you said. He's still the tailor to the queen's household, but there isn't a queen to dress. And this is where most of his income came, was by the piece. He received a salary, an annual salary, but he really made his money for the individual items that he made. And so his income drops. He's made tailor to the Infanta Maria Teresa, but it's just not at the same kind of level of income that he'd had before. And then his fortunes rise again when Philip IV remarries to Mariana of Austria. We have a young new queen coming to Spain, and that's where this totally reinvigorates his career. So the tailor's job is, the tailor to the queen is incredibly fortunate compared to other tailors, and he's got this very stable position. It was really hard to get fired. You had to really mess up. But his fortunes really did ebb and did wax and wane depending on the fortunes of the queens themselves, as you say.
So what were some of the big changes then when he gets his second queen?
Right. Well, with the second queen, this really revives Aguado's career. And this is also a moment, this is in the 1649-1650, where lots of things shift at the court. There's really a new, like in the late 1640s had been a really tough time. Spain's at war with France. There's just a lot of economic problems. It's a gloomy time. And at the court, it's a time of constant mourning after the death of the queen. And then the death of the heir to the throne, Baltasar Carlos. And so the late 1640s are a dark period, which is really reflected by the mourning dress that we see at that time. And then the 1650s bring this just sort of this new levity. We see this cultural revival. We see the theaters are reopened. The theaters had been closed in mourning for the queen. And then there were a bunch of attempts at sort of moral reform of dress and theater in the 1640s. And all of that kind of blows away. And so we see this reinvigoration of the theater, of fashion, and these things are very interrelated. And so for Aguado's career, this means he's got this teenage queen to dress. There's a lot more opportunity for invention and creation. And there's a total change in style at this time. It seems like it's a very exciting time in fashion in the 1650s in Spain, where things are just changing constantly. There's constant new inventions. So new colors are being used, new decorative trimmings, and what's being used one year is going to pass away and something else is going to replace it the next year.
Very interesting to hear about this revival. I wonder if I can ask about one of the things that influences this change, especially sort of year on year. There's stuff going on. There's war. There's more of these laws about clothing and fashion. How do those sorts of, in some ways, external events impact what Aguado makes for the queen, how it's portrayed in portraits, that kind of thing?
This is a really interesting finding, I think, particularly in the 1630s, stepping back in time here to the era of Isabel de Bourbon. Something that I noticed that was really interesting in the documents was in the mid 1630s, just as Spain is being drawn into war with France, suddenly we see Aguado introducing militaristic elements into the queen's wardrobe that hadn't been present before. And you see these in the portraits. And so, for instance, there's in the portraits of Isabel de Bourbon in the 1630s, you're going to see a lot of decorations that are called alamares. These are what in English we think of as buttons and loops. They're sort of decorative closures. And these were really popular on soldiers' clothing. And so they've been used in women's wear prior to this, but they're used in much more abundance. And they become really, really prominent in portraits of Queen Isabel de Bourbon at this time. Then after Spain goes to war with France, we see Aguado introducing slashing into the breast of the queen's portraits. And you can see these, or excuse me, into dresses for the queen. And you can also see these in portraits of the queen from this time period as well. And again, slashing wasn't totally new. Slashing was a military decorative technique that became really popular in the 16th century and was used on, for instance, in women's clothing in Spain. It was used in sleeves, but it hadn't been used in the breast of the bodice up until this time. So we're seeing this kind of subtle militarization of the queen's dress. And the way I interpret that is that we're seeing the queen really shaping her image to appear as this staunch defender of Spain. And she was in a really tough position because, of course, she was French herself, and her brother was the king of France, which is what her husband was then at war with. So we see this really interesting interplay of international politics, dress, fashion, portraits, all of a piece.
Yeah, no, very much kind of clearly playing off of each other. So mm-hmm. really interesting to see. If we're staying on this idea of external events or external things influencing the fashion and clothes, can we talk about the role of theater in shaping Spanish fashion, and especially how this changed over this is what makes Aguado's career brilliant, because we can see change over his career. It lasts mm-hmm. long enough.
Right. And the theater plays such an interesting role in fashion. And this is really an area for more investigation, I think. There were some wonderful, tantalizing bits of very concrete information that I ran across suggesting this interplay between fashion in the theater and fashion at the court. And I'll just give one example, which was at one point, Aguado used a fabric to make a dress for Queen Isabel de Bourbon. And the fabric was called Cisma de Inglaterra, the Schism of England. I thought, that is the strangest thing. So I just Googled this. What on earth is the Schism of England in terms of being a fabric? And it was a three-colored, very, very rich, very, very rich fabric. I remember it. It was maybe black, brown, and gold or something like that. And you Google Cisma de Inglaterra, and the first thing you come up with is a play by Calderón de la Barca, which had been performed just a year or two prior to that dress being made. And so I realized, okay, this must be a fabric that had appeared on the stage. That's the only explanation I can think of. There's no reference in the play itself to a fabric like this. So it must be that an actress wore a dress made of a fabric, this three-color fabric that was then used in the queen's wardrobe. So that was this amazing example then where the fabric itself was named after the play. And so there's a lot of direct interconnection between the fashions of the stage and the court. And the theater itself was such a place of fashion information being exchanged, because you have the actresses on the stage, and female roles were played by women in Spain, unlike in England at this time. You have the actresses on stage dressed in the latest styles. So while the male actors might be wearing antique Roman costume for a play set in antiquity, the female characters are going to be dressed in the latest styles because that's just much more entertaining. You've got the actresses on stage. You would often then have the queen herself appearing at performances on the balcony, dressed in the latest styles. And then you've got the women who are attending their performance dressed to the nines, because getting dressed up to go to the theater was part of the entertainment too. So everyone involved is looking at each other, and the plays themselves are often featuring latest fashions as plot points, as plot devices. So it really is this kind of extraordinary place for fashion.
Yeah, the place to be, the place to be seen, the place to see.
Exactly.
But of course, people enjoying fashion were not the only ones looking at all of this. There is, of course, also the church.
Yes.
How does the church feel about all of this? And to what extent does this impact what Aguado can and cannot do over the course of his career?
Right. Well, so the church plays such an interesting role in fashion at this time. It's a very conflicted role. And we see, for instance, that whenever sumptuary laws are passed, which would be restricting what people could consume, there were always two exemptions for the church and exemptions for the military. And the church, of course, uses fashion in a very visible public way to express its splendor and virtuosity through, for instance, spectacular ecclesiastical vestments. And I do say fashion very purposefully here because ecclesiastical vestments are using the exact same fabrics and trimmings that are in fashion at that particular moment in time, as the court would be using. And so you've got splendid ecclesiastical vestments for the performance of the liturgy or in public processions, which are, of course, going to be part of the spectacle and part of the attraction of going to these events. You have trend to dress religious sculptures, which I've already mentioned, which would be also dressing particularly sculptures of the Virgin in really elaborate, fabulous styles. The church was conflicted about that, sometimes tried to suppress that, but ultimately it always, whenever the church tried to suppress fashion always won in the end. There were moments when there were efforts to restrict fashions by the church, but it really never worked.
That sounds very triumphal for fashion. And obviously Aguado's career, as we've discussed it, there's a revival with a new queen. I mean, there's really a lot that he should be quite pleased with. And in fact, you say in the book that he had, quote, every reason to be optimistic about his family's future when he signed his last will and testament in December 1660. I think we've covered a bunch of the reasons that he seems pretty enthusiastic. Did his optimism bear out?
Well, so in 1660, Aguado is at the high point of his career. Earlier that year, he had made the trousseau of dresses for the Infanta Maria Teresa to go to the border of France and Spain to marry Louis XIV of France. And in 1660, Aguado is in his 50s. He's been the Queen's tailor for 30 years now. He's got a fabulous house filled with all the kinds of luxuries and comforts that an aristocratic home would have. He's married, has been married for quite a while. His wife seems to be quite happy with her. He's got three children, including his adult son, who has just married himself and he's an accountant in the king's household, which is really looking to sort of move the Aguados into this new level of service at the court, into the white collar bureaucracy. And so things are looking really, really good for Aguado at this point. And then, as the last chapter of my book describes, everything starts to fall apart after that elder son's premature death. And then Aguado finds himself, he has trouble at work. He actually is at one point arrested and thrown in prison for disrespecting his superior, who's the keeper of the queen's wardrobe, and things never quite recover.
That is definitely a contrast then with the optimism and the high point where he's at in 1660. Do you want to just add an additional bit about kind of the end of his life and sort of what happens after that?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, Aguado is arrested and briefly thrown in jail, but this is only temporary. He's pretty quickly put back into his post, and there I think it's, you know, he really was sort of too important to dismiss ultimately. And it was very unclear what exactly he did, by the way. It was the word that they used in the documents was that he was somehow inattentive. So he seems to have done something to disrespect his superior. But he is put back into his position. But then really, again, as we talked about earlier, his fortunes very much depend on what's happening with the royal family. And so the death of Philip IV in 1665 is going to mean a real drop off in the career of the Queen's tailor, because now, of course, the Queen is dressing as a widow. And that isn't nearly as she's not dressing in this sort of extraordinarily rich and complicated dresses that he'd been designing for her before. And then also shortly after that, the Infanta Margarita leaves for the court of Vienna to marry the Holy Roman Emperor. And so Aguado's got less to do, and so he's got less income. And also at this point, his own health is ailing, and he's really fixated in these years on placing his surviving children. He has two daughters, trying to give them a position at the court to make sure that they're going to do well after his death. I was able to trace to some degree what happens to his family after his death, and you do find, in fact, that that the family didn't do very well. Some of them, there's some documents showing there was a great granddaughter, I think, died in poverty. The person I really want to know about is his long-term wife, Bernarda Ruiz. I haven't been able to figure out when she died or what her conditions were at her death, but that's something that I hope that will turn up in the archives at some point.
Fingers crossed. That would be fascinating. Now that we have an idea of how his life and career ended, I wonder if we can kind of zoom out and assess his work sort of more broadly. Mm-hmm. And of course, his work through the lens of Velázquez's portraits, because as you said, we don't actually have the dresses.
Right.
So if we look at these portraits kind of as a whole, in some senses, what kinds of general trends or themes did you notice about how dress was represented in them?
Well, so, you know, Velázquez is a frustrating painter when it comes to fashion, because he, of course, what's so extraordinary about Velázquez is his ability to capture the appearance of reality, but with these very bold brushstrokes that that he's leaving out a great deal of information. And so so Velázquez is tough when you're trying to investigate his paintings to understand the details of fashion. And what I found from spending a lot of time looking at Velázquez and comparing what we see in his portraits to the documentation of what the tailor was actually making is that Velázquez is always representing court fashions that were being worn at that particular moment in time. And so in terms of the cut of the garments, in terms of the kinds of fabrics, even the colors of the fabrics that they do, it's always based in reality. Velázquez isn't making stuff up ever. And as is well known, the big emphasis on court portraiture in Spain is always on decorum and on and so everything is always very very decorous. What Velázquez is doing, though, is he is eliminating the details, and so very often he's simplifying things for the benefit of his compositions. And so he'll eliminate some fussy trimmings. I think what we can assume from looking at Velázquez's portraits is that, okay, this exact dress may not have existed, but we know that this style, this color existed, but the real thing was probably a lot fussier than what we're seeing in the portrait.
Very interesting to understand kind of how you were able to piece these together and give us a better perspective of when we see these massive paintings, what we might be looking for and, you know, what we might be kind of raising an eyebrow at, which is very helpful. That does pretty much obviously take us, well, now past the end of Aguado's career and towards the end of the book as well. So I really just have one final question to ask. Mm-hmm. The book is obviously pretty recently out, but given publication processes, etc., you had to finish it a bit ago. Is there anything you might have your eye on to work on currently or next, now that this is done, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this topic, that you'd like to preview for us?
Sure. Well, I'm very excited. I'm working now on curating an exhibition about Spanish fashion at the Hispanic Society of America, which is this extraordinary collection of Spanish art, and also in the museum, and also it's a library with it's an incredible rare books library of rare books and manuscripts. And so I'm working there on an exhibition about Spanish fashion in the 16th and 17th centuries, using their incredible permanent collection of objects to actually, instead of with words and pictures, with the actual objects themselves, to recreate this world of fashion that I was talking about in this book. And what I'm very excited about doing is, again, doing it with the objects themselves, and also doing it in a way that will then reach a broader public audience, so that sort of invite a lot of people into seeing this world that that we've been looking at through an academic lens.
Well, that's a very cool project. So yes. Best of luck with that.
Thank you.
And thank you for the sneak preview. Of course, listeners can read the book as well that we've been discussing, which will give them some insight into this without even necessarily seeing it yet. The book is titled Spanish Fashion in the Age of Velázquez, published by Yale University Press earlier in 2024, as mentioned at the beginning, both in English and in Spanish. Amanda, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's been a pleasure.